When I was around 14 or 15, my church youth group piled into a van to head for to head from Ohio to Wisconsin for a national youth gathering. It was sweaty and hot, driving through flat cornfields without air conditioning, and we quickly exhausted our tolerance for license plate bingo and car radio sing-alongs. We begged for a snack break, and our ever-patient youth minister complied, probably because she too was ready for a break from sing-alongs. We pulled into the lot of a big chain grocery store and all piled out, 15 youth out of a giant van, and I bought a jumbo bag of M&Ms, paid the cashier, and headed out the door. We were all heading outside the door, in fact, when a police officer stopped. He yelled for us to stop and to come back to the store, and he insisted that we empty our pockets. My friend Pete, who was a younger, quiet guy with freckles and unruly red hair, became upset, and my big sis instincts were activated, and I quickly became belligerent on his behalf. I hope it was the heat, but I was very angry. We didn't steal anything, so why are you bothering us? Is this because we're teenagers? Is this ageism? I demand to see your badge number. I demanded he change his tone. I was generally a very snooty little teenager about the whole situation. Pete, my little buddy, started to cry, and my ire increased. This policeman was a bully. I demand justice. How dare you stop us? Couldn't he see we were just a bunch of nice kids from Ohio? Except Pete was upset because he had stolen a pack of cigarettes. I couldn't believe it. You must have the wrong person, I said. None of us would ever steal. But the store had a security camera, and they were happy to show it to us. My shy young friend sticking a pack of Marlboro Reds into his cargo pants pocket. His parents were called. He was very, very seriously grounded for life. And the police let us go on our way with just a merry warning. On August 9th, a teenager in Missouri stole a handful of cigars. Those Swisher Sweet packs they keep by the convenience store doors that smell so bad. And later an officer who may or may not have known about the misdemeanor shot him at least six times, twice in the head. His body was left in the street for 4 hours, blood lining up onto the pavement. And then they threw him in a police van with tinted windows and took him away. No news was released about the death. It all spread by word of mouth, so friends and family gathered around the bloody spot on the pavement to share what little information they could. And they grieved, and they wondered if they would ever learn who killed their son, their friend, and their brother, Michael Brown. I imagine that you already know that the rules of engagement are very different for white teenagers than for black teenagers. But the anecdotal evidence aside, the statistics are pretty horrifying. Al Jazeera wrote that Ferguson, which lies in the suburbs of St. Louis, is a majority African-American town with whites occupying all the positions of power. It has an exclusively white police force, almost exclusively. There are 3 out of 53 officers are people of color, including the chief, a white mayor, a predominantly white city council, and the school board only has 1 African-American member. Socioeconomic conditions are even worse. 28% of Ferguson's black population lives below the poverty line. Researching Michael Brown's life was pretty depressing. 50% of his high school classmates graduated this year. In 2013, 92% of searches and 86% of traffic stops in Ferguson involved black people. The skewed numbers don't actually correspond to the levels of crime. 1 in 3 whites was found to be carrying an illegal weapon or drugs when they were stopped, but only 1 in 5 black people. This has been a really big summer for racism in our country. A few days after Michael Brown was shot, 2 white police officers in my hometown of Dayton, Ohio, shot a black man in a Walmart. And despite there being security cameras everywhere in Walmart, no security footage will be released. In fact, no details at all are being released. Meanwhile, statistics were released by the U.S. Department of Education confirming what I think most black parents already know. Black kids are suspended and expelled from school at a much higher rate than white kids for the same infractions. The far-reaching study found this is even true in preschools. Did you even know you can get suspended in preschool? Serious business. Where toddlers and small children are 50% of expulsions, but only 30% of enrollees. This epidemic of bad news about race points to the conclusion that Michael Brown being murdered in Ferguson isn't about Michael Brown, and it's definitely not about Ferguson. Yes, it's about systemic racism all over our country. Yeah, the police in Ferguson do seem to be especially racist and pretty disgusting in their comments, but they're just one tiny stream of injustice and an ocean that surrounds skin color in the United States. So I'm going to give you some quick information. There are four broad categories of racism, and the first is internalized racism. This one's the easiest one to understand for me because this is the stuff we have inside of us that we try not to think about. This is the stuff that we have gleaned from our upbringing, from things our grandparents and parents said, from noticing that mom locked the car door when you drove past black people on the street. This is internalized racism, and everybody has it. Negative and positive associations around color, about who's good at math and who is too dangerous to even drive by on the street. So internalized racism is plenty bad, but worse is interpersonal racism, which is where my racism comes up against somebody else's skin color. This is where we come into contact with humanity. This is when locking the door when you pass a black person on the street isn't enough, and you call the homeowners association to make sure they're still not selling to people that are black in your neighborhood, which is still happening in the United States. Levels 3 and 4 move away from the personal and into the big picture. First, we've got institutionalized racism, color bias in large organizations. The school suspension and expulsion rates I was mentioning earlier, that's institutionalized racism. Also, racism in incarceration. African Americans are jailed more often and for 20% longer than Caucasians when they have the same punishment, the same indictment. The crimes are identical, but they get 20% more jail time. Despite the much aligned affirmative action policies, universities are also practicing institutional racism when they almost universally at public and private schools give applicants a preferred status for admission if they have legacy status, meaning if your mother or father or grandparents attended that school. This benefits almost exclusively white people, especially white middle and upper class people. State-funded institutions don't have any justification for this, for giving an extra privilege to white kids, but our tax dollars have funded legacy admission and scholarships for generations. So the biggest and most prevalent kind of racism is the hardest one to put your finger on. It's structural racism. Structural racism hovers over every aspect of our society and makes it feel like maybe it's just illegal to be a black man in general, even if you don't do anything. Structural racism was responsible when Jonathan Farrell was shot to death in Charlotte, North Carolina. Jonathan, who was 24, was waving down a police officer after a serious car accident, and he was injured, and the officer shot and killed him, figuring that he must be a criminal. The officer faced no charges and was not suspended from duty. Around the same time, Darren Manning, a high schooler in Philadelphia, was stopped and frisked so aggressively that he suffered permanent loss of function in one of his limbs. Darren and his friends were hanging around in a public area when they noticed a cop was staring them down. Darren's friends just ran, but he stood there figuring, hey, hands up, I didn't do anything wrong, we'll get this sorted out. After his beating, the officer charged Darren with assaulting an officer, resisting arrest, and reckless endangerment. The officer wasn't punished at all, but Darren's charges did stand. With examples of institutional racism like these, it's not a surprise that African-American kids fear police brutality. New York City teacher Renee Watson hears students say things like the seventh grader who admitted, I'm afraid one day I'll be shot by the cops for no reason, just any day. So we can see that in Ferguson, the Ferguson murder of Mike Brown is less about one racist cop or even one city with a serious race problem and more about a whole nation with a race problem. Racism isn't only in our minds and in our interactions, but are in our biggest institutions and permeating our culture. Racism is both our problem and everyone's problem. So, now that we are mired in despair at the size of this injustice, what do we do? Well, this is a multi-step process. We are a church family, and together we mark the transitions and the tragedies of our time. So first, we mourn. First, we allow ourselves to feel the rage and the helplessness that perhaps you, like me, have been feeling the past few weeks. This grieving will take more than just today, but today we begin. As we mourn the loss of our nation's children, we must come to terms with our own deep-seated racism. We must face the demon of hate in our own souls. Demons bred from years of cultural voices telling us who is normal, white people, and who is not, people of color. Demons bred from centuries of racial turmoil handed down from generation to generation, a poisonous legacy. The temptation in times like these, where our very character of a nation is called into question, is apathy. Is turning away, saying, there's nothing I can do. I can't believe this is happening again, but there's nothing I can do, and just ignoring it. Apathy is our Unitarian Universalist original sin. There isn't any bigger. There is no greater test than which way we will turn when our fellow humanity calls to us. It would be easy to let the guilt and despair swamp our senses, to turn away from all that our ancestors have done. But my dear church family, my fellow pilgrims on this life's journey, we aren't going to do that. We're going to move forward. So how do we stand in solidarity with the people of color who are crying out against racism? Well, first, we're going to take a very UU route, and we're going to read. It's time we diversified our media. This week, as I was stunned as mainstream news commentators, not Fox, but CNN, used words like rioting and looting to describe two or three stores being robbed in the wake of the Ferguson murder. Thousands of people were in peaceful, large-scale protests from all over the state of Missouri. In fact, from all over our country, busloads of clergy people arrived, activists arrived, but all we heard about was a few bad apples. I heard the narrative of, oh, but he was one of the good ones. Oh, that hurts. The narrative that because Michael Brown should have been in college orientation this week, that he shouldn't have been one of the ones killed. The thing is, they're all good ones. Black lives matter. As if Michael Brown's death was only a tragedy because he was college bound. No, they all do. Regardless of college bound status or flipping burgers or high school dropout, Black lives matter. So we have to enlarge our media lens, because all this media we're exposed to seeps into us. It becomes us. So this week, I added three blogs to my regular list, the things I check every day. Color Lines, The Root, and This Week in Blackness. I'll post these online. You don't have to memorize it. I also really like the Zinn Educational Project on Facebook, because every day, if you like the Zinn Educational Project, you get a daily bite of history, the sort of people's history of the United States stuff that we don't get in school, where we don't learn about the great black pioneers, the great people of color who were scientists and artists throughout history. Then, after you read, it's time to become unpopular. It's time to bring up race in conversation, to bring up the Michael Brown, Trayvon Martin epidemic of death we're experiencing. So ask your friends, when were you first aware of race? When did you realize you were white and that some other people weren't white? How did that feel? What about race makes you the most uncomfortable? People of color are working ceaselessly to dismantle institutional racism. It is our obligation to at least try to dismantle our own racism and our interpersonal racism. Next Sunday, in celebration of Labor Day, we are going to talk more about solidarity. We're going to talk more about standing in concert with our brothers and sisters of color in a more major way. But in the meantime, you have homework. You have to read Color Lines and The Root and This Week in Blackness. And I promise it's not all serious stuff. There's all sorts of articles, entertainment, sports. But it's all from a black perspective, and it's different, and it's refreshing. And then I'm going to ask you to have at least one conversation about race. It won't be easy, but it's so important, and it will be enlightening. The title of this sermon is Loving the Hell Out of This World. And the thing about loving the hell out of this world is it's never going to be a discomfort-free process, and it never should be. If so, we're not doing it right. This is going to be hard, but it's going to be worth it. My beloved spiritual companions, we stand at a crossroads. The death of Michael Brown can lead to a shift in our violent history toward people of color. This could be our turning point, but only if we stand together with enough courage to have tough conversations. Our reading today, the second one, was a mother's love poem to her son Tommy. To Tommy, who eats chocolate chip cookies and lamb chops, climbs stairs and cries when I change his diaper, who lets me hold him only on his schedule, who defined my nature and gave me a new name, Mommy, which supersedes all others, who controls my life and makes me glad that he does. For Tommy, and for all the other black boys and girls who fear the police, whose greatest fear, like the seventh grader in New York City, is that they too will be randomly shot in the street, we repeat our refrain, the black lives matter. Chris and I are going to share a litany with you that was written in the wake of the Trayvon Martin murder and that I've adapted to our congregation and our time. After Chris or I speaks, your refrain will be, Black Lives Matter. And you'll know that it's your turn to say it when I gesture. A sound is heard in Ramah, the sound of bitter weeping. Rachel is weeping for her children. She refuses to be comforted, for they are dead.
Black Lives Matter. We pray for the families of children who have been slain, left to die on streets with less dignity than was given to animals.
Black Lives Matter.
A sound is heard in every city. Communities are weeping for their children. Our sons, like Emmett Till, Trayvon Martin, Ezeel Ford, Michael Brown, and John Crawford. Our daughters, like Ayanna Jones, Miriam Carey, Melissa Williams, and Tarika Wilson.
Black Lives Matter.
As people of love, we weep for the lives of all children who, instead of enjoying the sweetness of innocence, become victims of hate, victims of war, and victims of violence.
Black Lives Matter.
Now let us rise up and interrupt those rushing waters of violence that leave children and communities wounded and paralyzed, traumatized by internal disintegration and state terror. Let us rise up and demand this nation abandon its affair with beliefs, practices, and laws that are rooted in militarism, justified by racism, and propped up by systemic inequalities.
Black Lives Matter.
We will rise up against laws rooted in evil that have no concern for life, nor any concern for love. We will rise up until justice rolls on like a river and righteousness like a never-failing stream.
Black Lives Matter.
Spirit of Life, we commit ourselves to seeing all children as gifts from our wild, natural universe. No matter their age or their race, they have inherent worth and dignity and are overflowing with transformative powers and unlimited promise.
Black Lives Matter. And for that cause, we pledge to be hedges of protection for their lives. We pledge to stand against anything that threatens their potential or promise. Black Lives Matter.
We embody the universal spirit of Ubuntu. I am because we are, and we are because I am. We are all Rachel crying for her children. Therefore, we pledge to lock arms in solidarity with the families of the slain. We pledge to let our voices be heard all over this nation and this world, for we know we are called to do what is right and what is just because
Black Lives Matter.